Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today is our first installment of the monthly series, More with Captain Moore, where Matt is joined by Captain Moore for a talk about the decision-making process for naval leaders. Today's subject is the education and training of the 21st century naval commanders. Remember to subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and rate 5 stars. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is replacing your pets in the middle of the night with animals that look just like them. We don't know why they do that. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As our first podcast to be recorded in the new year, it's only fitting that we introduce you to a new series of ours, More with Captain Moore, a monthly discussion with Captain Dan Moore, USN retired. Captain Moore spent 29 years as a naval aviator with time as both a squadron CO and instructor at Northwestern University. For the past 7 years, he has worked in the aerospace industry and is now CEO of Small Unit Aviation, LLC. In our ongoing series, we'll discuss the decision-making process, both on an individual and organizational level, using examples from the present and history. This is loosely based on his lecture/discussion, Breakthrough Naval Leadership, which he presented at the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum in October of last year. Welcome, Captain Moore. It's a pleasure.
Hey, Matt. Nice to chat with you and your audience today.
Absolutely. I'm excited. Now, today's first topic, we discussed it earlier, is going to be the education and training of 21st century naval commanders. So as the first stepping off point in talking about in our series, the idea of decision-making, sort of what is expected of these leaders. And you wanted to start out with some opening definitions, namely methods of control. And for folks listening, some in the strategy field, when we talk methods of control, we're talking about internal control, because some folks like to talk about methods of controlling the battle space and what have you, battle space being just a random invented word. But we're talking about how to control and manage an organization and individuals internally. So, Captain Moore, I'll let you kick it off with that.
Okay, great. Yeah, and actually, this is about command and control, and my particular area of interest is commanders. And for definition purposes, typically you'll have more commanders in a mission-type environment, which is a loose rein type of environment, tends to be focused outward, high degree of uncertainty, and time constraints. The other is detailed control, and that's a very tight rein, and that's when safety is paramount. Nuclear reactor, for instance, you can't afford to have any freelancing around the control of a nuclear reactor. It's been my experience in the last 30 years that naval organizations have tended to emphasize detailed control and not emphasize mission control as it was practiced when I was a junior officer.
Something that I noted in the readings that you recommended beforehand, mission control seems much more about growth, and detail control seems much more about management, where mission control says, hey, I've got an organization, these are its capabilities, let me see what sort of excellence grows out of them. And detailed control seems more – I like to compare it to French, and this is going to get silly for some people, but French versus British gardening styles. You go to Paris, and all the bushes are in a row, and they're all trimmed like squares. And then you see near Buckingham Palace, and it looks like a natural garden. It's grown into its own beauty, as it were. So at least to me, it seems like that's what we're talking about.
No, I think that's a good analogy. One, again, if you've got a lot of time and a high degree of certainty, then detailed control is certainly a technique that a commander wants to use. Mission control, when there's a high degree of uncertainty, which I would think everybody agrees that the military and also commercial environments we're in are increasingly uncertain, mission control shifts the control from the center of the network to the edge of the network and allows the commanders at the edge of the network to stay focused outward on the situation and, in the military sense, in the enemy, the competition, and adjust based on what they're observing and based on the reality. So one of the things that information warfare has provided us is there's knowledge at the edge of the network and there's power at the center of the network. And mission control pushes that power out to the edge of the network where the commanders are.
Now, this leads us perfectly. We have these setup definitions. So we have tight control, we have detailed control, and we have sort of the empowerment of the edge, commanders at the edge, and that's mission control. Leadership traits of successful mission commanders was our big discussion topic around this central point, is using detailed mission and mission control. What's this balance? How do leaders use it? And what's historical examples that we have of people using this in the field? And
sure. I think there are two archetypes for both types of control. One is Lord Nelson of Trafalgar fame. He developed the Band of Brothers and historically is one of the best understood examples of mission control. The small group of leaders develop a common outlook and are outward focused on the situation and the enemy. On the other side is Hyman Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy, who epitomized detailed control and was able to help transform the Navy into a nuclear-based Navy with all of the benefits that that had. So that in my mind, we can discuss those further, but those are two historical examples of the two types of control.
I'm bringing up Nelson, furthering that point, is kind of roughly in the same motif as I've read before discussions of the East India Company and how you can run for a peacetime commercial example, how do you run a worldwide commercial megalith is the wrong term, but just this behemoth, and the idea being that all they had this implicit understanding, representatives of the East India Company, of how the company planned to operate, and they were empowered, and they were able to operate forward, but in such a way that they already knew sort of the commercial version of Lord Nelson, whoever was in charge of that organization or the organization itself as kind of a being. They understood, hey, this is what's expected. Maybe discuss further how Lord Nelson, you talked about the Band of Brothers, how Lord Nelson imbued this sense of mission control, this implicit understanding of his expectations with his subordinates?
Sure. Well, there's I think we can move forward into a more modern example as well, and John Boyd, I think, Air Force Colonel, father of the OODA loop, author of the Discourse of Winning and Losing and the foundation of a lot of the discussion we're going to have here. His initial group of friends and professionals had a high degree of integrity, a high degree of trust, and they, because they were focused on trying to produce the best possible aircraft for the U.S. Air Force, a very small group of people were able to transform the acquisition system within the Air Force to produce the F-16. So I think those principles that you mentioned, Lord Nelson, the East India Company, John Boyd, those are timeless principles that leaders that understand those can rapidly put those into their personal and also organizations so they can achieve an outward-focused, highly adaptive organization.
Now, how do you find leaders, or rather, how does a leader move themselves, this mission commander, move themselves out of that detailed control concept, namely because, as you mentioned with information warfare, to folks that maybe not up on the lingo, we're talking about the interconnected data networks of the Navy or any modern military force, where essentially I, sitting at the Pentagon in front of a map, can chat out to someone who is sitting on a ship in the East China Sea and say, hey, go 6 miles to the left. It's essentially at an often points the level of control that can be executed. So they say absolute power corrupts. Is that you have that power available and you say, I can control this level of detail. How do you get modern day commanders away from that? Or what are the traits that a leader needs that helps him resist that urge to execute that level of control?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think that has to come from the education of the individual leader and also the experience of the individual leader. Most junior officers, I think, are very familiar and appropriate. I think we have the best junior officers and non-commissioned officers the U.S. has ever seen. And that's because of more than 10 years of combat against a very capable foe. As those young leaders stick around or get out into industry, I think they will take the appreciation they learned about how effective mission control is and also understand when they need to apply detailed control. So if a commander is, let's say, a three-star, is not comfortable with mission control by the time he arrives there, I think it'll be very difficult for him to adopt a mission control approach. He also will require a higher level of leadership at every level. And if he doesn't have that, he may have to use detailed control as well.
This brings up a good moment to introduce some of the questions that were brought up by some SIMSEC members. Around the same kind of motif, Scott Cheney Peters and Michael Young asked the question that's roughly, how much can classroom instruction contribute to the development of leadership? How much comes from experience? What's more important, education versus training? So if we look at these leaders we're trying to build, if you want to build a mission commander, if you want to build an organizational commander, because I'm sure we can both agree that each situation involves a different skill set or perspective, what should be the perfect balance? What are we looking for? What kind of training or education should we be instilling in our leadership?
Well, I like the word balance, and I don't know that there's ever a perfect balance. I think a certain level of education, formal education, is necessary, particularly when someone is relatively young and you're trying to prepare them for a number of difficult assignments, challenging assignments. So I'd say maybe 10 to 20% formal education. Then I'd say 40 to 60% is sort of learning or experience in the field. So you're applying your education and you're learning in the field. And then ideally, you become self-educating and you also find a peer group where you can continue to evolve as a group your education. I think that's sort of and all of this is finding a balance relative to the external environment. You're always evolving and getting ahead of the external environment as opposed to an inward-focused, high control environment.
Now, Victor Allen had a question that goes well into this. Should it really and does it matter where the degrees come from? Like, why send people to a tier one school when he suggests, hey, DeVry will get the job done? And further, all three of them, Scott, Mike, and Victor, all asked the same rough question as tech major versus humanities. And I would add further, does it even matter? If only, as you say, 10% is really formal education, does it matter what the mix is? The Navy right now is pushing more tech majors. I'm of the mind, and Alex Smith has a great article, Lieutenant Alex Smith has a great article in Proceedings about how it's important to keep that humanities. I think from the naval officer perspective, leading abroad in a world where you are America's, often cases, diplomats in a place, that humanities might be more important. Does that really matter? If it's tech versus the humanities, is again.
Let me take you asked a couple of questions. The first is does the institution that somebody gets a degree from matter? The short answer is yes. I think it's best to have a mix. Certainly, the service academies have an important role. But I can also point to a Marine we had at Northwestern who was able to go study at Oxford, and then from Oxford he was able to become the first Marine to complete the Royal Marine Basic School. There are networks that come along with those institutions, and I think it's good. There were a lot of people at Northwestern. The only time that they would ever interact with a military person was with the ROTC students in their classrooms. And those individuals are going to go on and become very successful businessmen and politicians. And I think that having a mix of degrees and institutions is what you're looking for. So. Now, the second question is technical versus liberal arts. Again, I think you need a balance. I think sometimes if all you can do is liberal arts and you have no appreciation of the technical, that you've got some work to do. On the other hand, if all you have is technical and you don't have the diplomatic and the personal skills and the negotiation skills that a naval officer in today's environment, actually in any environment, needs. You particularly will avoid repeating some of the historic mistakes with an appreciation and understanding of history.
Now, that makes sense, but viewing, like we said, we would talk about historic examples. From the progression, you had mentioned in the notes before the show talking about Jutland, which I'd love to hear your thoughts on. But looking at guys like Admiral Beatty and Admiral Jellicoe, looking at guys like Nelson, and then recently on Midrats, Robert Work was asked the question, hey, what kind of education do commanders need? And he said, hey, it's a huge question. Now he's talking about autonomous systems and the idea of being able to control swarms and what have you. How has that balance between the humanities and technical skills and formal education, how do you see that having changed over time? Or does it even matter? Is it implicit sort of in the form and function of the organization that no matter where you come from, you're going to end up, because of that huge reliance on experience, you're going to end up fitting into that mold anyways. So you're using it in you viewing it in that historical perspective.
Again, I want to make sure I understand the question. I think having a balanced education that doesn't stop, it has to be continuous throughout a naval officer's career, is essential to dealing with the disruptive technological changes we're seeing, but we're also seeing disruptive political changes. If you look at what's happened in the Middle East in the Arab Spring, if you look at what's going on in Asia, I think those are examples of where just a technical education is not going to give you the depth of understanding you're going to need as a naval officer to positively affect events in those environments.
I guess let me reword my question. I think of a better way of putting it is how do you view the needs of training and the nature of a mission commander changed, in the sense that do you think if Admiral Nelson or Admiral Remy were to exist, or I'm sorry, not Admiral Remy, Admiral Beatty were to exist today, would they function well in the fleet if you took away that difference in technology? So they're like, what, chat? I don't know what that is. Why are there moving pictures on these screens? Take that away from them and put them into a scenario with a modern-day conflict and a modern-day fleet. Would their concepts and ideals and their background work for them, or has that changed over time?
No, I think the leadership principles around mission control are timeless, and they're outward focused on the situation. You can use various forms of communications as they evolve and the speed of them to reduce your internal friction, okay, and to facilitate that outward focus. Or, and this is a concern of mine, you can do what I've observed in the last 20 years, you can use those enhanced forms of communication to focus internally, to instead of having lateral flows of information to between commanders, you now have vertical flows of information, and you really begin to shift your organization's focus and initiative from outward focus to inward focus to process, and I think it would be very easy to conduct a series of tests and see how adept officers are at various levels, from fleet commanders down to individuals, lieutenants and marine captains, on how developed their skill sets are in able to adapt between detail and mission control.
What do you think a test like that would look like? The Navy just introduced its commanding officer's qualification. For those who know, it's a really detailed, in-depth test about everything from rules of the road to basic administration. Now, for your test, go ahead.
The simplest is force-on-force replay. You can do it in a modeling and sim environment, but I would also argue you'd need to do it actually in the fleet, and you need to do it in the field, and it could be as small as two units competing against each other or two fleets competing against each other. And I think very quickly it becomes apparent as to those individuals that are able to focus outward and adapt as the environment changes, and those individuals that have a strong tendency to focus inward and try to correct the internal functioning of the organization instead of adapting to the outward.
You know, what you're discussing does sound a lot like CSG 360, which we talked to John Paris about during our innovation podcast. So folks that want to listen in on that can go back into the archives. But NWDC, Navy Warfare Development Command, they came up – essentially they sat down and said, you know what? We don't really do – we do COM2X and we do other military exercises, but we don't really do that free play that you were kind of talking about on the strike group level on a regular basis. And they came up with a war game using charts and dice and what have you, and it's really impressive. But they said, hey, strike group commanders, we're going to bring you in and we're going to have you fight against a red force in some place in the world, we've invented a scenario for you, and just drill them over and over and over again. And that's kind of been embraced. So what you're talking about is something that the Navy has actually, I think, started to move towards as they understand the threats a little better not so much the understand the threats better, but view them better, and they understand that these are real things that are the internal and external are both important. You can't just know yourself, but you also have to know the enemy to a point. Now, how would you view integrate? Now, you talked about this from the JO to the mission commander level. How would you see integrating that for more junior officers?
Well, I think I see lots of evidence that below the 04 level and below, there still is a need and a development for a high degree of initiative and creativity. And I think that's wonderful. As people are pressed into their careers, and their concerns about reducing the risk around their careers, I've seen a more emphasis of detail control. And particularly when you get to these large fleet exercises, they tended to be, and I'm dated there, they tended to be mostly scripted. People showed up on time. If they showed up on time, then it was a check in the box, and they moved on, and that was declared a success. There was very little room for creativity and at the fleet commander level. And, you know, 3rd Fleet fighting 6th Fleet, for instance, or a crew des grew fighting a car grew in both synthetic and real environments. I think those are one of the useful.
Lieutenant Commander Armstrong talks a lot about Lieutenant Sims, Admiral Sims. So the version he talks about often is the Lieutenant, the JO version. And your point brings up a really interesting quote that he had in one of his USNI blog posts. Every fiber of my being, I loathe indirection and shiftiness and where it occurs in high places, and it's used to save face at the expense of the vital interests of our great service, in which silly people place such childlike trust. I want that man's blood, and I will have it, no matter what it costs me personally. So that kind of drive for, I think that the mission, I think that our capabilities are most important, and the you talk often about Colonel Boyd is the to be versus to do, that emphasis on to do. Though the example I think that best illustrates what you're discussing right now is the choreographed training that sort of illustrates and emphasizes your own institutional view is the Millennium Challenge with General Ripper is the one that I always go back to, back when he essentially sank the fleet in a matter of hours using irregular means, and they refloated it, said, nope, that's not scenario we want to play. We would rather test this. And the question became, well, now, wait a minute, no one's going to step back and take a look at the fact that this man just sank a carrier strike group, or rather, I think, just the carrier. He just took it out. And they said, nope, we're not interested in that information. We want to move on to something else. So I think that's for folks that want to look into that. That was a really good example of what Captain Moore's talking about when it comes to that wanting to see what one wants to see rather than what's real.
Well, and that's and it was General Van Riper, V-A-N space R-I-P-E-R.
Oh God, I've been pronouncing his name wrong for about 2 or 3 years.
Anyway. And he's a perfect example of a 3-star who taught himself how to apply and these both at a personal and an organizational level. And the Marine Corps is better because of that. One last thing, and I really applaud Commander Armstrong's familiarity and making sure people understand the lessons of William S. Sims, because it's a good template for both junior and senior officers to understand what happens when you take on the status quo. And once you understand that template, you can predict what the status quo is going to do to try and protect itself from these kinds of very significant changes. Today we're going to see more and more of that. Again, one of the reasons why it's useful to study those individuals and have an appreciation of our own history, but also the resistance to significant innovation by large organizations.
You know, it is important to note the powers that be, the status quo, is not always unwilling to recognize and embrace change. I mentioned Admiral Rami in error earlier. He was one of the men who was in charge of Lieutenant Sims, and he invented a job, special intelligence officer, for Lieutenant Sims because he recognized his insight and his knowledge and his desire. And he basically said, to quote Lieutenant Commander Armstrong, he had free rein to work on, study, and report on whatever he wanted. And you look at an institution like the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell and NWDC, and you say, okay, the institution may be unwilling to change quickly, but it is, in many cases, building sort of modes and channels for folks to instill that change. So I think today, particularly, I think we're in a unique moment in history where there will always be resistance to change and to innovation and to that critical thinking that threatens the status quo. But I think we're in a unique moment where, thanks to and sort of a commercial parallel, you look at things like this is not really a poor example, but it doesn't really fully explain it. But you look at Facebook, you look at Kickstarter, you look at LinkedIn, sort of these informal networks, these entrepreneurial efforts that exist in the real world. So the Navy today has a parallel to look at and says, wait a minute, these innovative outbursts are not irregular and they can be very useful. And so the people that are now building these processes see parallels that exist. So this is not something unusual or bizarre to them. They say, oh, I know what's happening here. I can recognize this from other commercial ventures. Let me try to apply these to my organization to gain those benefits. So it is not as foreign today as it may have been in the past.
Well, I think you bring up a lot of good points, and I'll highlight the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. This is a self-organizing community of interest and hopefully a community of practice at some point that like-minded, very talented individuals are coming together to solve very important problems. And I think that that's one of the most exciting things I've seen in the last 30 years is because of the ability to find people online and to communicate and evolve ideas online, there's some really strong potential there, and it's very exciting.
And it's in many corners. For example, hey, this podcast, we're from SimSec, and that's another sort of self-organizing, self-selecting group of folks that are interested in Defense Entrepreneurs Forum is very sort of organization and tech-oriented in the U.S. Navy. You look at the CRIC is very tech innovation, process-oriented. The SimSec, we talk a lot about tech as well, but also policy innovations, looking at the broader scope of strategic interests and how the United States and other countries, too, interact with those. So it's a really rich environment that we exist in where all these organizations are popping up. And, you know, they've popped up in the past. There's other – we're just building on the shoulders of giants, as it were. But going from here, you did note the Battle of Jutland, and you mentioned Mattis. And I was wondering if you wanted to touch on those points you had on them because, A, Mattis is awesome badass. And the Battle of Jutland is interesting as well. And then we'll move on to you had that talk you wanted to engage with the integrity, trust, appreciation, and leadership. Sort of what are those traits? How do we use them? And so on. But before we jump into those, I don't want to miss any rich material is maybe we could talk about Jutland and a bit about Mattis as sure. those leadership traits for successful mission commanders.
Well, there's in order to understand Jutland, and there's a very good book by Andrew Gordon called The Rules of the Game, and he looks at what happened between Trafalgar and Jutland over 100 years. Trafalgar, where Lord Nelson was killed, was the height of mission command within the Royal Navy. And from that point forward, and the Royal Navy basically owned the seas. But in that period of time, there were a group of admirals who and officers who increasingly opted for detailed control. And it's very well detailed. It's very well described in the book, and it's timeless. They started micromanaging ship commanders via flag signals. And as a consequence, they almost lost the Battle of Jutland, which was in the World War I time frame. Fortunately, they did not. But that is a perfect example, I think, of some of the organizational weaknesses that accrue to a peacetime or a relatively peacetime Navy and the belief that all you need to do is have detailed control. So I think that's part of the value of Jutland. And then finally, Mattis. Mattis, I think, is an example, and the latest is he's getting ready to write a book, or he's writing a book. He's an outstanding example of the warrior monk who basically devoted himself to the study and understanding of war, and consequently was able to consistently make a difference at every level in his career, from first lieutenant up through four-star central command commander, of someone who's got the right balance of technical and leadership and outward focus on the enemy, and is a complete inspiration to anybody that's ever served with him.
There's a great quote by General Mattis that I think is important. We talked about technical versus the liberal arts, and a lot of folks, especially on the Navy side, concentrate on the technical side, especially in the surface warfare community, and I'm sure for pilots as well. My brother's going through the pipeline, and it's a lot of checklists. It's a lot of understanding his instruments and the engineering of the aircraft. And on ships, of course, it's the same thing. It's a giant moving machinery space. And General Mattis says, the problem with being too busy to read is that you learn by experience, i.e. the hard way. By reading, you learn through others' experience, generally a better way to do business, especially in our line of work, where the consequences of incompetence are so final for young men. Thanks to my reading, I've never been caught flat-footed by any situation. It doesn't give me all the answers, but it lights what is so often a dark path ahead. So when we look at those technical degrees, and that's very internal, you know, we're like, hey, we know how we operate, but when he talks about that path ahead, that's outside. So reading those books, learning from military experience is incredibly, incredibly important. And two, I wonder what you think about this is, would you say that Admiral Nelson is also a very singular moment? Because at least it seems to me that from his Battle of Trafalgar all the way back to the Battle of Cape St. Vincent, where he sort of made a name for himself by breaking that detailed command. He said, I see an opportunity and I'm going to execute. And the battle turned in their largely in their favor because of that action, is that really outside of the confines of Admiral Nelson, is that the British fleet never really embraced that?
Well, I'm not the right guy to answer that question about. That's certainly the case that Andrew Gordon makes, is in part because it was a peacetime Navy. And the nice thing is when you're in peacetime, and you don't have a credible foe, you can convince your focus, I think, naturally tends to shift inward, and you can convince yourself that by internal efficiencies that you're getting better and better. And that works until you run into an enemy or a society that has continued to evolve, and all of a sudden you don't have the commanders, you don't have the equipment, you don't have the focus that is necessary to get ahead of and beat the enemy.
Let's take what we've discussed so far, and we'll move on to your final topic for the day, which is integrity, trust, appreciation, and leadership. Sort of taking all these concepts that we've discussed, successful mission commanders, reflecting on mission versus detailed control, and sort of how integrity, trust, and appreciation enters into this equation, and how a leader can use those to his advantage to embrace that mission command or mission leadership concept.
Sure. Let me, and again, when Boyd was developing his theories, he would talk about high entropy, which means there's less energy available to do useful work. And the example I like to highlight for that is Congress. And then low entropy, there's more energy available to do useful work. And I think a carrier flight deck is a perfect example of a low entropy organization. People are focused on the mission. The CO of the ship is not telling the junior enlisted guys to turn left, turn right. He's actually observing and intercedes only when safety is paramount or there's an unusual circumstance affecting the overall situation. So and in that low entropy organization, there's a very high degree of integrity, trust, appreciation, and leadership. That's allows people to anticipate what the person next to them is going to do, that the person's going to be there both physically and in the future, and stay focused outward. When you take those out, and I think a perfect example is drones, okay? Drones are the ultimate detailed control system right now. And there will be opportunities for them to demonstrate emergent behaviors when they become in swarms. But there's no trust, integrity, leadership, and appreciation in a drone-like force, which I think is very useful, and there's definitely roles to play. But when confronted with uncertainty and time constraints and spoofing and jamming and all the different things that a capable foe can do, that's where you need to have both the integrity and appreciation of the human-based organization and then the robot-based organization.
Well, a lot of the weaknesses that, I mean, certain implicit technologically, we don't have the ability to make drones as autonomous as we wish, but a lot of the weaknesses that we imagine in a drone force, for example, come from that concentration and that clinging to that detailed control, where it has to be my hand is on the joystick all the time, which means that you have created a whole series of ways that other people can intercept the signals from that joystick. So a great example of the weaknesses of detailed control is that detailed control gives you more opportunities through communication to be intercepted, and where implicit control and trust, we talk about it in an organizational sense, but in a tactical sense as well, the less you need to communicate with your mission commander, the less signals are in the air, in a very literal sense, and the harder it is to find someone because you're not constantly trying to communicate with them. There's not a whole bunch of radio chatter in the air. There's not a lot of data to be intercepted or even interrupted. Is that trust allows your force to not only be more effective in the field, but also allows it to be safer and harder to detect. Kind of an interesting sort of tactical view of how we can use this to our advantage.
Well, and trust is based on competence. You know, if somebody is a good tactical commander, the trust level skyrockets. If somebody's a poor tactical or operational commander, then trust appropriately is withdrawn, and a lot of times detailed control is substituted out of necessity. But I think, and again, we need to be able to do both, and we need to recognize that when we do mission control, that it's going to require greater, more capable leaders in order to do more mission control as we move forward.
Maybe you could talk, we're talking about integrity and trust very explicitly, but I think implicitly we're talking about appreciation. Maybe you can talk to that point in particular, because I think we're talking about it and assuming it, but maybe just sort of lay out the importance of appreciation and how a commander uses that as a way to embrace that integrity and trust.
Well, I think a good commander, particularly with his non-commissioned officers and his junior officers, appreciates how central they are to the success of the organization. And instead of viewing himself as someone on top of the pyramid and everybody supporting them, he is actually anticipating and providing both leadership and resources to enable the activities of the junior people in the organization. Those people that are on the edge of the network, interacting with reality, and the experience of the senior officer allows him to facilitate and reduce the risk, yet allowing those NCOs and officers to do the downfield blocking necessary for the whole organization to thrive.
Maybe then, taking a step back, if we sort of recognize that to a point that this has changed, that we've moved somewhat away from integrity, trust, and appreciation, not so much the integrity part, and it's not that we don't – it's perhaps is a bad wording. It's not that we've moved away, but we've rather not relied on them as much. What, as an organization, has caused us – to do this? Is it just purely technology and we've always been like this, but technology hasn't allowed us to execute this level of detailed control? Or is it something organizationally that we have in a way that our attitude has changed that's made us move away from relying so much on that trust and moving more to that micromanagement?
Well, I think there's always some organizations will be better than others in terms of mission and detailed control, and some individuals will. What I saw, and I don't know if it's changed much, is as we move to a centralized air tasking order, individual pilots became cogs in a scheduling machine, and there was far less opportunity for them to adapt based on the situation they were seeing. I think that that gives people a level of comfort sometimes, but at the risk is your organization is mismatched with reality. And I think a good example of that is Tora Bora, when they had Osama bin Laden cornered, but they couldn't get the aviation resources, they couldn't get a lot of the resources there in a timely fashion so that they could actually trap him and get him at that point. So I think because of the communications and the online, there's an inherent tendency for some people to think they're in control because they can micromanage the communications and the individual assets, which they can do. that there needs to be that balance of, okay, let's bring in the General Van Ripers and do a force on force where the enemy has a vote, the enemy has a chance to disrupt, and is not going to act in the fashion that, that you've gotten comfortable managing. So I think it's a continuous, if you're wise to build in these exercises, and they can be at any level from two ships and two airplanes to all the way up to fleets, to build that into your education and training.
Maybe as an educational opportunity for the folks listening, is can you describe in more detail what the air tasking order is, how it's changed, sort of a because we say that, and conceptually I'm sure everyone understands what we're talking about, but kind of an inside baseball, not really so much about mission command versus detail control, but so folks can learn is what is that and what's it do, because it maybe that'll give people a better insight kind of to the relationship of command and what we're talking about.
Sure. And I'm only going to address the air tasking order from the period of basically 1989 to 2005. I'm not familiar with what's gone on since then. But in 1990, the decision was made to that all air forces would be linked to a 72-hour planning cycle, and that 72-hour planning cycle would, schedule airplanes at times, altitudes, routes, and basically was efficient in terms of utilization of resources. But there are countless examples where those resources were mismatched with what was going on the ground in particular. And as there were emergent phenomenon on the battlefield, on the ground and in the air, fortunately, individual pilots and commanders would find themselves adapting to the situation. And my hat's off to them. But there's a problem with the entire organization if the entire force is managed down to the minute and is managed down to a three-dimensional position. You run the risk of someone coming in and you become very predictable and being able to completely disrupt your force and make it irrelevant.
Goes back to Lieutenant Commander Armstrong's just a font of awesome quotes, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the idea that someone sitting at a table and saying, well, my administration was going perfectly, and then a war showed up and messed it all up completely. So the idea of a very efficient system that's doing something, but that thing has absolutely nothing to do with what you're trying to do with the ground, or at least tangentially.
Correct. And you can take the, Arab Spring is a perfect example of a highly disruptive series of political events. And I think we're still struggling, meaning the U.S., on what does that mean and how does the U.S. play or not play a positive role in the Arab Springs. In a combat situation, let's look at IEDs. We have the $25 or less highly evolutionary, highly destructive explosive device, and our acquisition and planning cycle takes years and then produces a $100,000 robot to try and keep up with the $25 or less IED. I think that's another perfect example of a system mismatch between the reality and our ability to produce solutions.
And you mentioned how this concept of mission command is sort of universal throughout history. And even this concept too, like the talking about asymmetry. People look at IEDs as if this is a new concept, but this goes all the way back to the Battle of Syracuse, with the Athenian Navy having to build these extra complicated super ships to get rid of these little poles that the Syracusans were just digging into the sand to mess with and or stop Athenian ships. So this is not, you know, people talk about like, oh, fifth generation warfare. It's first generation warfare. The weapons have just changed. And it's just like those concepts are uniform. There's a point where, I think in the Fallout series, there's a quote that says, war never changes, and to a point that's true, both in the kind of nature of the changing of threats and also the nature of what a commander needs to succeed, like we're talking about here. Do you have any final thoughts, kind of insights maybe? Talk a little bit from your career, because you had a long, illustrious career. So that's 29 years in the service, 7 years working in the private industry towards sort of the same goals of excellence in aviation, and still using that mentality. Maybe a few moments that brought you kind of down this path, talking about mission control and thinking about Boyd and how you got interested in all these topics.
Well, I think one of the most big impacts was obviously the opportunity to learn from John Boyd from about 1989 until he died in 1997. And his to be or to do discussion and brief definition there, you know, you can be somebody, get the promotions, and the system will reward you for the behaviors that that it wants you to demonstrate. And that's not, it sounds critical, but there are some very good people that have gone down that path, and they've made a big difference for the country. For Boyd and for me, it was a choice of, do I want to do those things that I think are best for the organization, even if the organization doesn't want to admit it? There were two areas that I was interested in. One was deployed combat readiness. I know that when I was a squadron commander that our JOs were not getting the flight hours they needed. That discussion continues to this day. I think both flight and steaming hours are probably woefully underfunded. And it's in those environments that our junior leaders develop the skills and the initiative and the confidence they need as we move forward. Try and fix air-to-ground fratricide or improve that, not a whole lot of success in that for a variety of reasons. But those, when you choose the to-do path, all sorts of very interesting opportunities present themselves, and the chance for an individual to make a significant difference also. But you better have some grit, as Commander Armstrong has pointed out.
A good point to close on, I think, to follow on to your to be or to do definition from Colonel Boyd, is I believe, and I apologize if this is not the person who suggested this, but our good friend Rich Gansk wanted you to talk about your statement, don't get yourself killed in a good fight. So we'd say to be or to do, but to a point perhaps, to do does have its limitations as well.
Yeah, and they're personal. You know, I think depending on an individual's circumstance, how much risk are you willing to take on in order to try and improve the situation? And there are lots of good fights out there. You ought to pick them. And then in my mind is, you also ought to have a point at which you're willing to go or not go on behalf of that fight. And that's part of don't get killed in a good fight.
Well, Captain Moore, it has been a pleasure. I just want to remind everyone that this is going to be an ongoing series, more with Captain Moore. I will take credit for the fun play on words. If you think it's a horrible pun and awful, well, sorry, it's not going to change. The readings from today's podcast that kind of informed our discussion, not necessary, but interesting, Navy Doctrine Publication 6 on Naval Command and Control, Andrew Gordon's The Rules of the Game. I'll admit that I didn't manage to read the book beforehand, but I read a few reviews provided by Captain Moore. John R. Boyd's Organic Design for Command and Control is a slideshow brief that if you can't find it, come and ask us. Of course, we can give it to you. George Gilder's Knowledge and Power, which is available online at the Hoover Institute. And, of course, if you search for Lieutenant Commander Armstrong and put in Sims, I'm sure you'll find any number of things that tangentially or directly relate to any and all of my references to him during today's show. So next month, we'll have a new topic talking about decision-making. And, of course, I hope that you subscribe to us on iTunes, Xbox Music, or Stitcher Streams Radio. We think that this is a fine product. And tell your friends and leave a rating, because it does matter, not just for our standings on iTunes so that we get more attention, we get more listeners, and we get more input from you, but also to let me know how we're doing on the show, what you want to hear about, and what you think we need to change. That's a great. Of course, if you want to put down something to change, put down 5 stars and then say, hey, I think this would be better. No need to, you know, give me 3 and then a correction. I'll correct it. Just take that into account and just give us the 5. Cap Moore, any closing statements, thoughts, reflections before we finish up this first podcast of the new year?
No, thank you very much, Matt. And one of the best sayings, and this comes from one of the better squadrons I was associated with, was if we're not having fun, we're not doing it right.
I think we can all agree with that. Well, Captain Moore, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.